part of what you build through a tax system is a social contract. Well, it's very hard to think about how to build a social contract in a world where it's donors who are donating to your government, not you yourself paying a share of the taxation.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name's Tim Phillips. There are daily headlines around the world about tax evasion, the tax burden, redistribution, basically how much government should tax us and what they should spend it on. Cannot economic models contribute to a debate that already encompasses philosophy, sociology, and political theory? Tim Besley of the London School of Economics thinks so. In his 2018 presidential address to the Econometric Society, he chose to talk about state capacity and the social contract, laying out a model that helps to explain why we have both Nordic countries with high rates of personal taxation and compliance, and failed states that have neither, and also how states that are in between can evolve in either direction. Tim joins us today to discuss his ideas and what they tell us about how states develop. Tim, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is an unusual topic to pick for the Econometric Society. Why did you choose it?
Well, for two main reasons. One is, as a president of the society, you get an opportunity to give a sense of what you think are the important questions, be a little bit open and speculative, but equally be able to try and sketch out the core ideas and develop them to a point where they can be a paper that can be read by other professional economists. So I was keen to use that to try and provide some kind of nudge in a direction which I think is sorely needed within economics, which is to take seriously ideas around the dynamics of culture, as well as the kind of standard fare of economics, incentives and how markets work, and even how governments work, which is a pretty mainstream topic within economics. But to try and suggest that there's an important dynamic that needs to be studied by economists, which is not just the traditional economic dynamics, but also social dynamics. And I think in the context of the topic which I took, which is why do people pay their taxes, this is really needed. And I came to the topic in part by reading a lot of the history, political science, perhaps more than I read the economics. And then the challenge was, well, how do you bring these ideas into economics? Although I think the key figure, perhaps the one who's influenced me more than any other, is someone who's famed in economics, and that's Joseph Schumpeter, who wrote an essay in the early part of the 20th century called The Crisis of the Tax State. He posed a question, which I suppose was posed at policymakers as much as fellow economists at the time, which was, how is it that you can get a level of sustained taxation above 10, 15% of GDP, which would seem like a rather quaint thing to be discussing, since by the end of the 20th century, a little less than 100 years after Schumpeter wrote, it was commonplace to find countries that could raise 30, 40 plus percent tax burden. So there's a really interesting set of dynamic questions. How did we get from Schumpeter's starting point to what we got by the end of the 20th century? And more importantly, why was the pattern so different across countries? Well, we might say we look at Norway or Sweden, that's been the pattern of change. But you look at countries like Somalia or Kenya or even Mexico, they're not countries that have experienced quite the same transition that we've seen in what we now call advanced countries. So it raises a whole set of questions about why does the dynamic arise in some places and not others? And that opens up a whole series of research questions.
And it's fair to say as well that the transition from Schumpeterian era taxation to the sort of personal tax levels that a lot of us pay now has transformed the societies and the role of government within the societies in which we live, hasn't it?
Yes, and it's been part and parcel of that. Of course, it enables us to transform the role of government. The fact that we can have a debate, as we're having here in the UK, about how much to spend on the health service is premised on our capacity to raise significant sums of money through either VAT or personal income taxation. So the debate about the role of the state is itself premised on the capacity to raise revenue. But equally, the capacity to raise revenue comes from somewhere. We need people who broadly comply with the norms and comply with their taxes. And for that, we have to have a state that is both competent in the way it delivers and also offers something relatively universal. I think the state functions best when the vast majority of citizens perceive the role of the state to be in their joint interest. And some of the most important programs, the health service would be a very good example. One would buy into a view that it's a very broad-based program. Most people, some point in their life cycle, are beneficiaries of that system. So you can get very broad-based buy-in to that. And that enables you to raise the kind of tax revenues you need then to sustain that. So the interplay of those two things is absolutely critical.
You talk a lot in this paper. You base this paper on the idea of the reciprocal contract, where our choice to pay tax really is a choice that we make based on what we're getting in return. A lot of economics focuses more on the idea of the coercive government extracts the tax, and then we analyze the policy choices based on that. Are they missing a trick here?
Well, I think the traditional view, the very bog standard economic view that we basically have to have taxes coerced out of us, has been a bit of a blind alley if you take it to its limit. I mean, of course, there is a coercive structure in place that if you don't comply with the taxes, you have the threat of the courts. Mm. And even historically, you could be thrown in jail. And occasionally now, you can be thrown in jail for not complying. So there's no question or doubt that the coercive function of the state lies behind all of this. But I was very influenced in my own work by a political scientist called Margaret Levy, who wrote a book called Of Rule and Revenue, where she looked at the broad history of this, starting in the 19th century. And she came up with the term quasi-voluntary compliance, which I thought was an interesting term. And it's one I try to capture through the reciprocal motive, that it's not entirely voluntary. I'm sure all else equal, most people who fork over whatever proportion of their income they do to the tax authorities would rather they didn't do it. Of course, if they could still enjoy the same benefits from the state. So in that sense, it's not what you might call purely voluntary, but it's quasi-voluntary to the extent people are subscribing to a norm of reciprocity. So they understand the bigger picture. They, as citizens, have internalized that norm to a point where it is more or less automatic and part of their internal code of conduct that they would prefer to subscribe to the norm than not. And it's how we achieve that, the psychology of that, if you like, or how it gets embedded in our consciousness and the way we behave is what's interesting. The argument I make, and it kind of links to a wider literature on cultural evolution, is norms propagate effectively when there's an element of cultural fitness, to use a term from biology. Populations, in a biological sense, reproduce when one population has a trait that's fitter, meaning can reproduce faster in a biological sense. Well, in a cultural sense, you're comparing different modes of compliance. And the question is, when does that mode of compliance become self-fulfilling? Well, if part of that is that there's a reciprocal obligation on the part of the state to provide public goods, but more generally, broad-based programs, then you will come to believe that you're better off reciprocating that towards the state, if the state is a reliable reciprocator. And how do we create reliable reciprocators? We have institutional arrangements that do it, namely that we try and discipline politicians who fail to live up to that. We kick them out of office, or we, in the limiting case, if it's corruption, we prosecute them, whatever it takes to keep them obeying the norm on their side. And provided they're obeying the norm, possibly through the institutional framework, we are ourselves willing to subscribe to that norm. The norm propagates because it is a culturally fit norm, namely it suits us in the environment to become norm compliers, not least because if we're not, we can get prosecuted. So there's a sort of coercive downside. But there's also a sense in which we come to actually internalize this, to think it's part of being a good citizen that we conform to this norm. And so we actually become culturally fitter by cohering with the norms of a society. We learn to do so, and we are better off for doing so. It becomes part of our internalized codes of conduct.
And that's how we make that jump from thinking about reciprocity at the micro level to making that assumption that there is a reciprocity at the state macro level that it's possible to model, which you've modeled.
Yeah, exactly. Often, though, if we think, where does our instinct for reciprocity come from? It probably comes from our own ancestry. We were living in small-scale societies for the vast majority of our existence as human beings. There's even evidence, and I cite this actually in the paper, that bird populations seem to have norms of reciprocity to which their behavior coheres. Trivers, who was one of the earliest researchers in biology on reciprocity, pointed out that for reasons of biological fitness, reciprocity was advantageous. So we probably have instincts, some of them relatively hardwired from our experience over many centuries or thousands of years, living in small-scale societies where reciprocity was a very powerful driver of our behavior. And perhaps what a successful state is able to do is to latch on to a latent instinct and to reproduce that at macro level. And to the extent it does that, by being able to show that good government is possible, that we can actually have governments who don't just behave corruptly, but do actually provide goods and services that people broadly value, that then creates a positive social contract, which can be why government can work. And those ideas are what I'm largely trying to capture in this paper.
And we're thinking about paying tax in this context. And to motivate this, you did a piece of work to look at the difference in attitudes to tax compliance. And there is a huge difference both within states and among states, isn't there?
Yeah. And one thing that's very striking, so there's something called the World Value Survey, which I used. Actually, also something called the European Value Survey, which is just an extension of that, which asks respondents a question about how far they think it's legitimate to cheat on their taxes. And one thing that's surprising, at least if you take the very standard economic view, is the vast majority of people will say it's wrong to cheat on your taxes. So that social attitude, however you choose to interpret, is quite strongly ingrained in people. Although one thing when I present this, I always point out to the audience is that all the men in the room should hang their heads in shame, because there's a very strong relationship between this and gender. Namely, men are much more inclined to think it's illegitimate to pay their taxes than women. But so you can correlate this with various attributes.
Yeah.
But exactly as you say, there are big differences across countries. And there are differences with characteristics like more educated people are less inclined to say it's good to cheat on your taxes. So it does look like we form people's preferences through things like education.
Now, I'm going to try with you to draw out how you conceptualize this for anyone who really wants to get into it. Really do read the paper, because there is a lot of detail we won't have time to go into here. But it is hard. It's a relatively simple model, isn't it? There's an elite that decides policies. There is a group of people that pays tax to them. And at the beginning, it's just a single period model. Is that rich enough?
The whole point is to depart from a static model, because I'm interested in how all this evolves over time. I think there's an interesting question lurking behind this, which we might tease out a bit about.
Yes.
How economic modeling is done and what,
yes,
what's the purpose of economic modeling. The aim of modeling is not always to be fully realistic. You have to strip away features of the world to home in on the thing you want to cast light on. I'm certainly not claiming, in the way I chose to frame this, that I'm trying to create a realistic picture of all the features that drive tax compliance in the world, of which there are many that are left out. But the thing I wanted to capture with the kind of bare bones of the static environment that you just referred to is the idea that there's a body, and I call that the elite, which is the government. Ultimately, when we pay our taxes, we pay them to an elite. Of course, in a sense, that's not even a bad model of democracy. There is a political elite, and we want them to do the things on our behalf that we approve of, which is spend money on healthcare or infrastructure or whatever. So they become a de facto elite. So I began with a very simple model. There's an elite who we have appointed, perhaps, or who are just there for hereditary purposes. But there is an elite, and we rely on that elite, if we're going to pay tax revenues, to discharge those revenues in a way that we approve of. And then the question is, if we can choose to cheat, not pay our fully obliged taxes, what would drive our motives? And the way I formulate that is that if you're a reciprocator, you're more inclined to pay, i.e. less inclined to cheat, if you see the government spending on the things that you approve of, and they're going to be in the modeling framework, they are public goods. Less on transfers, the kind of pet projects of the elite. Olden times, it would be building palaces or other things that elites enjoyed when they dominated government. I have a very stark division between the things that just benefit the elite and the things that benefit the mass of citizens. And as a reciprocator, I will respond to that. If I see the elite spending more on the things that are advantageous only to the elite, there's a motive of negative reciprocity, namely I'm more inclined to withhold my taxes even if it comes at a price. If I see them spending more on the things that I think are broadly beneficial to citizens, I'm more inclined to comply. And I contrast the motives of what I think of as just straightforward materialist citizens, the ones that economists have traditionally modeled, who are neutral on this. They don't tailor their behavior to how the state does or does not spend the public revenues, versus the reciprocators who have this either positive reciprocity or negative reciprocity according to what the state is doing. And that gives me a kind of static base camp with which to study the thing I really care about is how does this reciprocal motive evolve over time?
Yes, and yeah, we have to strike out from the base camp, don't we? And we have to let this model roll forward over time to see what happens. What does happen?
What happens, the model predicts that if you take this cultural fitness argument that I talked about a little bit earlier, that you'll look at who are getting higher psychological payoffs in the world. Are they the, what I'll now call rather loadedly, the civic-minded citizens, the reciprocators, or are they the materialists? Do the materialists win out in the sense that they will either comply or not comply entirely based on material motives versus the reciprocators who are complying or not complying based on their reciprocal motives? And something kind of interesting happens. If you can trust government to spend on public goods, that will itself motivate the reciprocators to pay more tax. So governments who are able in some way to deliver more public goods will find they have more revenues with which to do it because they will be able to cut out a certain amount of the non-compliance. Now, that has an additional benefit because there's a kind of complementary effect between me being a reciprocator and living in a society with more reciprocators. Because when I reciprocate and everyone else does, we have even more revenues being spent on the stuff that I like. And that pushes up the relative payoff of reciprocators against materialists. And that creates this kind of dynamic effect, which means you can move towards a society with a richer, stronger civic culture because there are many more people around behaving as you do. So having many people behave in this way raises the payoff of all the reciprocators. So that's the upside, and that sounds great. What's the downside? Well, you can also get a kind of decline in civic culture. If you're living in a world with very few people who are behaving this way, that means governments are less likely to want to spend on public goods because the cost of them not spending on public goods is lower because they don't lose that much tax revenue because there aren't many people exercising negative reciprocity and the system moves in the opposite direction. So you get a kind of bifurcation between societies that move in this positive direction, let's call them Sweden or Norway, and societies that seem trapped in a sort of negative situation where they are unable to develop a strong civic culture. And therefore, all the tax revenues they're raising in the stylized version of the model are coming through coercion. But there's a real limit to how much tax revenue you can raise through coercion. So they're stuck in a, I suppose what we call in economics, a low equilibrium trap that they can't break out of because their civic culture is so weak.
And I know the model is highly abstracted, but seeing as you did mention Sweden and Norway, does this give us an insight into how countries that are stuck in that low equilibrium can begin to move to another equilibrium?
Yeah, so the most obvious thing, I talk about this in the paper, is to think about reforms in institutions. So one way you create the trust that the government is going to spend on public goods, not transfers in the simple version of the model, is by creating more constraints on their authority to force them to comply more with the things that the citizens want. Now, there are a number of ways you can do that. Strengthening oversight through parliamentary democracy. Think about having citizens represented in a legislature that the elites have to get their proposals through the legislature. So let's think back to Magna Carta. What was Magna Carta? Magna Carta was a change in which, albeit one set of elites, the barons, wanted to hold another elite, the king, to account. But what it did, it's meant that it restricted the power of the king. So right there, although it didn't move us all the way to anything approximating a fully representative system, it was a step en route towards having a serious curb on executive authority, which would shift us in a direction of the mechanism that I describe in the model, which can get you in the end fully to a strong civic culture. And we observe through history many such institutional reforms. Now, those reforms are good in and of themselves. You will get more public good spending if you constrain the executive in the way I describe. But what hadn't really been thought about and what's novel in the mechanism I describe, you get these complementary changes in civic culture that go with institutional reform. So kind of culture and institutions become complementary factors in the way political, social, and economic systems evolve.
There's been a lot of empirical work and a lot of work in other social sciences about the value of institutions in development recently. Does what you're seeing in this model chime with all of that work, any of that work?
It does very much, but I think it takes it also in a slightly novel direction. I came to a lot of this through a partial dissatisfaction with giving institutions too much of a role. Namely, institutions are incredibly important, but it's as if the debate had kind of gone, if you just get your institutions
right. Get your institutions right and the rest will take care of itself.
We observe countries, that have had great difficulties in actually getting the institutions right. So I have some work with Torsten Persson that predates the work in my presidential address, where we tried to argue that you need to evolve democratic values in order to get sustainable democratic institutions. And the mechanism of a joint process of the evolution of values and the evolution of institutions was what underpinned that work. So really understanding how institutions can change means in part trying to understand how values change alongside institutions. But the other thing is to realize that there are certain benefits from changing institutions via the impact that that would have on the kind of cultures that evolve. So it's perhaps not surprising that if you look at countries with long histories of either executive constraints or democracy or however you choose to measure it, they will on average have stronger institutions in certain spheres that kind of mirror the cultural change that goes alongside the institutional change. So it was really trying to enrich debates about the role of institutions to encompass culture, but culture that itself is not fixed, that changes, to represent the fact that from all the survey and other attitudinal and other kinds of data we have, there are just these big differences in culture that need to be explained, not taken as just given.
There are many countries, many of them stuck in that low equilibrium, where the government isn't really financed by personal taxation at the moment. Do we need a different model for that?
You put your finger on something quite important. Is if you take societies that are considered fragile societies that have come out of long periods of either state failure, civil conflict, or whatever, it's a massive challenge to transform those societies into societies that can do the kind of stuff that we take for granted living in developed Western democracies. To come back to your specific question, one particular challenge is there are all sorts of external agencies who are out there trying to fund the kind of stuff that in the model is funded internally. Well, it's very hard to think about how to build a social contract in a world where it's donors who are donating to your government, not you yourself paying a share of the taxation. Yeah. So it would create a headwind. And actually, another example of that are the oil-rich states, which effectively don't need taxes because they have oil revenues and they can pretty much fund most of the needs of government. A lot of people say, well, they don't need taxation because they've pretty much got all the public finance that they would ever need. That's neglecting to realize that part of what you build through a tax system is a social contract. So you often will have a weak sense of obligation between citizens and elites in a world where you haven't done it via taxation. So taxation matters much more than our traditional take, which is we need taxes to spend on goods. Even if you have all the revenues in the world you want, it's very hard to build a state without a real core sense of reciprocal obligation, I would say, to build a really strong, compelling social contract.
Another important institution is, of course, democracy. You abstract away from that a little bit. You mentioned that, of course, there is always still an elite, no matter who wins the election. Does putting democracy into your model change anything?
I like to kick back a little bit on the use of the term democracy. Mm. At the very least, because it conjures up sometimes unhelpful imagery. Now, what do I mean by that? At the very least, democracy is two things. It's probably many more than two, but I'll start with two and not one.
Yeah.
It's a system for selecting to public office. So president, prime minister, legislative representative. And that's often what people immediately think about when they think of democracy is, do you vote for your leader or not? But it's equally a system of providing constraints on executive power. So if you look historically, the biggest and most significant changes in government actually don't come through elections or the creation thereof, but finding methods of creating constraints on executive power. So I referred to Magna Carta. there was no election in sight when Magna Carta came along, even though many people think it was the first flowering of what we now call democracy. It was really a constraint on the king's power. If you look at the other landmark moment, as often acknowledged in British history, which was the Glorious Revolution of 1688, equally, no elections in sight. What was established there was that the king ruled at the pleasure of Parliament, and the Parliament could pass an act and dismiss the king and replace the king. It was an assertion of a certain kind of constraint on executive authority. Judicial independence, absolutely key, and I would say probably the most important constraint on executive authority is that rulers can be taken to court for violating either the law in general or sometimes on the basis of natural rights and other principles of constraint. So these things, I would argue, are incredibly important. And probably in the end, this is perhaps I'm slightly overstating the case, far more important than the conduct of elections. And that's often recognized. And when it is recognized, it's pretty powerful. So if you look at how the end of the Lebanese Civil War came about, it came about because there was a credible power-sharing deal put in place across the different groups that have been fighting each other. And only then could there be moved to an electoral system with severe constraints. In fractured societies in particular, that's important. But I'd say it's important in general that democracy works well when there are a series of institutional arrangements in place that mean those who govern have a strong incentive to govern on a broad-based coalition, not on a narrow agenda.
And where we've reached with this sort of shows that your framework isn't really about taxation at all. It's not about getting and spending money necessarily, is it? It's much richer than that as a conceptualization of how states work.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we've come through a period of studying these issues now within economics and obviously being respectful to work in law and political science and sociology to, I think, a much richer understanding of what it means to have in a government that can be effective. When I was brought up as an economist, we had this model, which I was very taken with, of benevolent government and all the wonderful things that benevolent government could do for us. But it kind of was a gradual dawning on me, at least, and I'm sure on many others who began there, that there was no guarantee that government would conform to all of the wonderful principles of benevolent government unless you could find ways of making it work. Those ways are partly institutional, they're partly cultural, and having effective politics. And it's when people bash politics, by the way, I get irritated. Not all things that happen inside politics are things that we approve of. But politics is an enormously enabling thing. Namely, it's only through legitimate political interaction that we get stuff done. So you could be all in favor of the benevolent government model and think of all the wonderful things, but you aren't going to get it to happen unless you embrace politics as the means of delivery. So it's really important not to spend all your time complaining that politicians don't do what you do. Mm-hmm. It's thinking of ways to make the state work more effectively if you want to bring about those solutions that economists think are so important.
Tim Besley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's so much more that we haven't had time to discuss today, but good news, it's all in Tim's working paper, which is called State Capacity, Reciprocity and the Social Contract. It's easy to Google, you'll find it everywhere. And it also has plenty of ideas about how this work's going to be developed further. I think you're going to be doing a lot more on this, aren't you, Tim?
Absolutely. Even today, I've been working on how we think about the dynamics of environmental change and the need for cultural dynamics in the context of really reaching an accommodating solution to deal with the problems of climate change. So these ideas are very elastic and apply in a wide variety of areas.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Subscribe to us on your podcast platform so you never miss an episode, and check out more in a series at voxdev.org.